What would you say to somebody who's coming across your work for the first time?
Mouth breathing is a disaster for your health. 11 years ago, when all of my respiratory problems that I had quite a few, suddenly went away once I learned how to breathe properly.
How much truth actually is there in mewing, and is it just something that silly, insecure teenagers do?
It is not important for young kids to mew. It's important for young kids to have proper oral posture. These are two completely different things. You will never resolve anxiety unless you get control of your breathing. When you're constantly overbreathing, you're sending your brain signals that you are stressed out. And then your brain reacts by having you breathe too much. Learning how to breathe deep and slowly through your nose can really transform your health.
This is the Loaf Podcast. Welcome back to the bakery, everyone, where we break bread with the world's finest. Today, we're here with James Nestor. He's a renowned journalist and best-selling author of the book Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art. James, thank you so much for being here with us today. How are you feeling?
Thanks a lot for having me. Feeling pretty good.
Cool. So just a little introduction for our listeners about the kind of person you are and the kind of things you believe. You've said before that you're a skeptic. And me personally as well, hearing about your work for the first time, I was a little bit skeptical, as I believe many people can be, about the idea that breath can be such a powerful thing when it seems so simple, oxygen in, carbon dioxide out. What would you say to somebody who's coming across your work for the first time to sort of begin to give them the idea that breath could be something quite powerful for our health and for our mental health as well?
Well, by the nature of my job, I have to be a skeptic. Right. I'm a science journalist. And so I hear something that piques my curiosity. And my job is to go out and learn as much about it as I can. And part of that process is to measure it. So measuring things is a great stick in which we can sort of figure out if something is real or not. And if measurements continue to add up and end up being the same over various repeated experiments, then that's where the truth is. That's where the data is. So, personally, I will have to say that my experience into breathing and my apprehension, which was very strong, was sort of shattered around 11 years ago when all of my respiratory problems that I had quite a few, suddenly went away once I learned how to breathe properly. And once I was introduced to proper biomechanics and posture. And I thought this was interesting. I wonder if this would also happen for other people. And it turns out hundreds of thousands of other people have had the same experience, millions at this time. And so that interested me enough to spend many years researching it.
Yeah, you, in terms of research and the way in which you kind of had this, this experiential belief. So in the sense that you believed it because you experienced it. You begin your book Breath by describing an experiment where you're forced to mouth breathe for 2 weeks. Could you, for our listeners, maybe explain that experience and what you learned, you know, through that lived experience about how important nose breathing actually is?
I had talked to several experts in the field, and we know that nasal breathing is far superior than mouth breathing. There's absolutely no debate about that among people who study this stuff. We've known this for decades and decades, so no controversy there. But what hadn't been done is human studies looking at how quickly the damage from mouth breathing would come on. And we haven't done those studies because A, there was no funding for them, and B, a lot of people didn't want to run them for ethical reasons, because they didn't want to purposely inflict pain upon people, which is what happened with the chief of rhinology research at Stanford. When I asked him, I said, you're at Stanford, man. You're at the top of your field. Why don't you do a study? Even 20 people would be interesting. He said he couldn't. So I volunteered, and one other person volunteered for a 2-person experiment. And what we were doing wasn't like trying to establish new science so much as we were to personally experience what the science had already told us, that mouth breathing is a disaster for your health. And I felt that within a couple of days, and we have the measurements to prove it.
What was that like?
Oh, it was terrible. We knew it was going to be awful, right? So there's no bones about it. And some of my friends were like, oh, this is like a Super Size Me thing where you're eating McDonald's for 30 days. But it really wasn't, because if you look at the amount of people who are mouth breathing constantly, especially during allergy season, you realize we were just putting ourselves into this position that so many other people knew. That the difference was we were measuring it the whole way through. So our sleep took an enormous hit. Athletic performance took a hit. We couldn't focus. Dry mouth all the time. I mean, it was awful. Blood pressure skyrocketed. So on and on and on. As advertised from all of the previous studies, don't do it. And the thing that's sad is so many people are walking around mouth breathing, wondering why they have chronic migraines, wondering why their blood pressure is just through the roof all the time, wondering why they're getting constant cavities. And no one's telling them it's the pathway in which they breathe.
Ever shown up to the beach with a big bush, getting rejected left, right, and center, so you have to walk away with your pubes between your legs? Then get yourself a Manscaped and rule the beach. Wear your shorts with no shame. Get the Performance Package 5.0 Ultra now with a discount code LOAF to get a full 20% off, so that your baguette leaves no crumbs.
You know, I used to personally be a mouth breather. I don't know if the word mouth breather, in fact, has actually got this nowadays. I don't know how long it's been around, but there's this very strong negative connotation. And in fact, it's used as an insult as well. But anyway, I used to breathe through my mouth. And the reason was that I had a deviated septum. So I struggled a lot to breathe through one of my nostrils. And so I got a septoplasty. And since then, I've been able to breathe through my nose a lot better. And the thing is, deviated septum is very common among the general population, but a lot of people can't afford an operation or might not have the resources there or not the insurance. So my question is what you would recommend for people who can't, recommend to people who can't breathe properly due to like physical restrictions, such as a deviated septum.
Yeah. So, you know, you've got up to 50% of the population that breathes through their mouth, at least on occasion. And you've probably got 100 different problems that these people are suffering from. So you can't offer a blanket prescription for everyone. Some people have a septum that's clearly deviated. Other people have turbinate problems. Other people have chronic congestion from allergies or some autoimmune response. I mean, this list goes on and on and on. So what you can do, if you do have the time and interest, and I hope you do, is to figure out your core issue behind why you can't breathe in and out of your nose. About 30% of the population has something called nasal valve collapse, where the flesh around their nostrils is either too thin, so when they inhale, it flutters, or their nostrils themselves aren't big enough. So it's just much easier for them to breathe in and out of the mouth. But there's so many reasons why people do this. And you have to take your own self-responsibility and figure out where the issue is and then figure out how to clear it up.
And you talk at the beginning of the book as well about how it can affect jaw structure as well, because you're constantly having your jaw hang down, you're breathing through your mouth, it can cause teeth issues. Now, a solution which has been memeified on the internet and treated as something almost silly, insecure teenagers do for the sake of aesthetics is mewing. How much truth is there in mewing? I know you mentioned it in your book, but we want to hear it firsthand. How much truth actually is there in mewing? And is it just something that silly, insecure teenagers do?
Yeah, I interviewed Mike Mew and John Mew before they were cool superstars.
Wow.
Very interesting. I was there early on. Very interesting dudes. So here's what we do know, and I can tell you what we don't know, but what is probably true. Why do we have crooked teeth? Okay. Why do we have crooked teeth? Because our mouths are too small. That's why. So you're going to hear all these different reasons, and they're all wrong. You have crooked teeth because when your mouth is too small, your teeth have nowhere else to grow. So they grow in crooked, period. So some people think that mewing, which is this technique of using your tongue to push to the roof of your mouth, can help expand your mouth. And by expanding your mouth, it can help tone and open up the airway. We know that that is certainly true for young people. So one of the reasons why young kids end up having mouths big enough and they're teeth growing straight as all of our ancestors had, is they had proper oral posture. And there is this whole new field called myofunctional therapy that is teaching kids proper oral posture because we've completely forgotten about it. So when you swallow, your tongue should be at the roof of your mouth, not pushing against your teeth. Go look at a bunch of kids now and watch them eating. Almost all of them are pushing their tongue against their teeth and throwing them out of alignment. So there have not been any randomized controlled trials of mewing. There never will be. But on principle, it makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
How's that for an unsatisfactory answer? Yeah.
Well, it's better to have the nuance than to not have it. So I'm glad that you clarified. I've heard that it's definitely important in young kids to mute. So I guess the fact that this is something which is catching a craze in teenagers is maybe a good thing.
Let's talk another about craze. That mm-hmm. for 1 second mm-hmm. for young kids to mute. It is not important for young kids to mute. It's important for young kids to have proper oral posture. These are two different, are two completely different things. And the reason why all of our ancestors, all of them, had perfectly straight teeth, if you go back 1,000 years and older than that, is because they had proper oral posture. They knew how to chew, and they were chewing all the time. They knew where to place their tongue.
Yeah, but it really is quite interesting because it has become such a craze. I mean, especially for younger people who are on the internet, they might see like it is quite crazy. There's this whole culture around it where, you know, if your jaw is backwards, then it has almost negative social connotations. It's really related to like levels of attractiveness, and it's really is then becomes part of this meme culture where you see people like pointing at their jawlines because they mew, and it's quite hilarious actually.
I wish I was on TikTok. I've never been on it. I've heard these stories that a lot of people are into this. And you know what? Let's look at the positive side of this. Is having your tongue in the proper position helps open up your airway. Exercising your tongue in your mouth helps tone the airway, allows you to breathe better. You know, is it allowing you to push your face forward as these kids want? I don't know. I think that it wouldn't be that hard to conduct an experiment in which you just scanned people's heads, right? And then 6 months later, looked at if there had been any movement or any bone growth in their head or looked at their airways. But again, people prefer to go online and tell their own personal story than to actually take the time to collect real data.
You said mewing is not important. The oral posture is important. And part of what you mentioned there is the chewing. So could you just unpack that for our listeners as well a little bit, maybe how that can be important to keeping the right face structure to open up the airways and so on?
Sure. So if you look at ancient skulls, and I've looked at hundreds and hundreds of these things, you notice that from all over the world, they all had not only straight teeth, but these very pronathic faces, wide jaws. Their faces grew outwards. And 90% of us have a jaw and a face that is growing the other way. It's flat and it's growing the other way. So the next thing you have to do is ask yourself, well, how did this happen? Right? This wasn't random. Something happened. And it turned out that as we started processing foods more and more and more, especially in the industrial age, these foods became very soft. And we no longer were chewing. And if we weren't chewing for up to a couple hours a day, which is what our ancestors were doing, we would not develop the proper musculature and skeletature. So that's why we have mouths that are too small for our faces and crooked teeth. So if you look at the flip side of that, well, if you do chew like our ancestors did, then you would develop this wider mouth and this bigger airway, which is true. So chewing is especially important for young kids, not to eat applesauce and Gerbers and, you know, candy and cake. All that stuff's fine on occasion, but it's to eat real food, food that requires you to chew. And when you're chewing, to have that proper oral posture, pushing that tongue to the roof of your mouth every time you swallow.
It's interesting because a lot of people tell me that I have a really small mouth. So maybe that has to do with how I chewed when I was a kid. But anyway, we recently interviewed Wim Hof, who I know you spoke about in your book as well. And so he's a man who has completed feats such as staying submerged in ice for hours on end. He's run a half marathon nearly naked in the Arctic. Most people and will know him, and most of our listeners will have watched that interview as well. And you credit his ability to complete these feats to tummo breathing. But could you explain for our listeners what tummo breathing is, perhaps with a short history of it?
So Wim studied various breathing modalities in order to tune his body up to do all of these amazing things. And one of these modalities is this ancient practice of tummo that developed from the Bon Buddhists thousands of years ago. What this does is it has you overbreathe, breathing like that, and then holding your breath and compressing that energy, that breath, that heat in your body. And we know that this is a real thing because there have been different studies looking at these Bon Buddhist monks breathing in this manner and heating up their extremities by, you know, 7, 8, 9 degrees Celsius just by breathing in this way. So Wim has used that, and he's used that to sit in an ice bath for almost 2 hours at a time. I know Wim. He is such an amazing character, and he's inspired millions and millions of people to take control of their own health. And this is just one of the things that he uses in his toolbox to help people control the heat in their bodies, but also to help heal themselves of chronic conditions.
For a beginner, maybe, short of chucking yourself in an ice bath or going to the Himalayas, what's a protocol somebody could do to get started with it? You mentioned just quite quickly, but maybe you could expand on a protocol somebody could do to get started with that kind of overbreathing.
Yeah, Wim offers, there's some free YouTube stuff. You can watch Wim do it. That's a good introductory way of exploring tummo breathing. There's also other classes that people teach. There's some books. It's a little harder to learn it from books. But I don't have the time to teach you it right now. If we had a half an hour, I could teach you how to do it. And it absolutely, beyond any sort of placebo effect, really heats you up. I mean, I've used this when I've been very cold and was amazed by how effective it is. If you've ever been in an ice bath, that's very big out here in California right now. Breathing is an essential part of getting through those 2-3 minutes. And if you don't have your breathing locked in, it's really hard. And I believe almost impossible. I watch people come in and hold their breath and all this and then leave. So your breathing is fundamental to controlling your nervous system control.
Yeah, I am. Just a personal anecdote, I have a little tub at home, which I use with my dad. He's very much into ice baths. And before we use it, so I've done it a few times, kind of like 7-8 minutes in 4 degrees. But every time we kind of do like 12 minutes of just breath work. And then once you're in, you know, it's all about controlling the breathing. So it's, you feel your internally, if for those listening who might want to try it, it's such a great feeling to feel the self kind of heating up from the inside. It's quite extraordinary. And following from that, I was wondering how that would then lead to health benefits. How does that work maybe from a more scientific perspective?
Sure. So staying in an ice bath, 7-8 minutes, very impressive. I can't last that long. And you notice that if you were just to hop in that ice bath without the breathing warm up, be a very different experience. I don't think you could make it 7-8 minutes unless you were really forced, really, really pushing yourself. So these two things go hand in hand. This is the whole peanut butter and chocolate of wellness right now, is ice bath and breath work. What's interesting is there have been studies of this looking at people with autoimmune diseases, looking at people who were exposed to the endotoxin version of E. coli after just 4 days of being trained in ice bathing and breathing. And those who were exposed to it suffered no symptoms of when they were injected with the endotoxin of E. coli. And people who weren't ice bathing and breathing suffered terrible symptoms. So we can look at things like CRP, C-reactive proteins, and you can just also look at these people with these chronic health conditions, specifically autoimmune diseases like MS and psoriasis and more, And they just don't have these conditions, or they're significantly reduced after a few weeks of doing this. So this is supposed to be impossible. You're not supposed to be able to consciously take control of your immune function, but it turns out we can. And so biology books and medical books have had to be rewritten around this new protocol. So we're just at the beginning of it, of really understanding it. And it's fascinating, having heard about this 8 years ago, 9 years ago, and it was very fringy. And doctors said, whatever you do, don't do this. You're going to have a heart attack. This is dangerous. It has not been studied. And here we are 10 years later, and at least half of the doctors I know have ice baths in their house. They are huge fans of it. They're huge fans of breath work. So sometimes it just takes a little while for the rest of society to catch up. But, you know, beyond that, I can speak to it personally. It has transformed my health. I'm a huge fan of it. It's not for everybody. So also use, you know, your own judgment if it's right for you to explore.
I think people have 100% caught on to the physical health benefits. So it's almost like one of those things that's a given now, the way other things in science would be like, get your greens in. It's just about maybe even access to having an ice bath, but that's sort of all on the physical health side. And you talk in the book a lot about mental health, anxiety, how certain breath exercises can help with that. So could you tell us what can be done for mental health, where the limits of it are, and what specific practices in breath work maybe help there?
I heard this from a psychologist a few years ago, and he told me, he said, you will never resolve anxiety unless you get control of your breathing, ever. You can take whatever drugs you want, go to as many vacations or many classes as you want. You will never, ever figure it out. And I'm starting to believe him. I'm starting to think that that's really true. And I believe him now because if you look at people who have chronic anxiety or panic disorders, they almost always are over-breathing, sometimes twice as much as they should be. Their carbon dioxide levels are very low in their exhaled breath because they often are mouth breathing. So they're completely disconnected from their breath. And if you look on the flip side of that, of what happens when you allow these people to control their breathing, to breathe slowly, to breathe softly, rhythmically, in and out of the nose, their CO2 levels go up and they feel the sense of calm. And this is not a placebo effect. This is biology. The reason is when you're constantly overbreathing, you're sending your brain signals that you are stressed out. And then your brain reacts by having you breathe too much. So this is our stress reaction. We breathe too much. We hold our breath. We breathe too much. And these people are caught in this vicious cycle of constantly overbreathing, being stressed. So they're breathing back again and just over and over. And what I think is fascinating and also really depressing is almost none of these people are told that their symptoms can be significantly reduced by controlling their breath. And I think that that's an incredible disservice to a bunch of people who are in a bunch of pain.
You mentioned from the overbreathing, that their carbon dioxide becomes very low. For somebody who hasn't read your book, I think that might sound, that might ring not quite right from what you learn as you're growing up, that you're trying to expel carbon dioxide. So why did you say that? Why is it good to have high carbon dioxide?
So of course, with every exhale, we are expelling carbon dioxide. That's how it works. Oxygen in, CO2 out. We're supposed to have a certain amount of carbon dioxide in our exhalations, around 5.5% CO2 in our exhalations. When you breathe too much, you start offloading too much CO2. Okay? So when you're offloading too much CO2 from your body, without that CO2, blood vessels start constricting. And this is why, if right now you were to overbreathe, you're going to feel some tingling in your hands and some lightness in your head, right? You're going to feel a little dizzy. This is not from an increase of oxygen, but a decrease of circulation. Because without that CO2, you get this constriction. And so these people who are constantly overbreathing, their CO2 levels go down because they're just breathing too much of it out too quickly. And when that happens, they start to feel dizzy, and their fingers and hands and feet are cold, and they're irritable. And if you talk to people with anxiety and panic, this is exactly how they feel all the time. And people just aren't talking about the direct connection of their breathing patterns to these conditions.
It's just linking that now back to the mouth breathing. Am I wrong in thinking that nasal breathing also helps with anxiety, or are the two not very linked?
It can help tremendously with anxiety. Right now, if we are mouth breathing, how hard is it to breathe very, very quickly? It's very easy to do that, to be over breathing, because there's no buffer there. The air just comes in, right?
Sure.
There's no filter. Now try to do that nasal breathing. It's extremely hard to hyperventilate when you're nasal breathing. Mm. The reason is we have all of these different structures. It looks like a seashell if you were to look at a deli slicer view of our heads. And these different structures buffer this air. And they make it so that air is forced to take more time to go more slowly. And this forces you to breathe more rhythmically, right? So that slower air that's coming in, that rhythmic breathing, calms the nervous system down. And if anyone is apprehensive about this, look at heart rate variability within 30 seconds of breathing very slowly, very calmly. And you see it just go through the roof, because this is your heart rate and your nervous system is responding to the way in which you're breathing. You're telling your body and your brain that you are safe, that you are in control. So it's able to go about its business instead of taking care of the emergency at hand.
I know also that which nostril you breathe out of can have a profound effect on whether it's stimulating you, waking you up, making you more anxious or not. And that seems like a crazy idea to me, because it's almost like two sides of the same coin. Which nostril should we be breathing out of to calm ourselves down? And how does this work?
Well, you should be breathing out of both of them. So I really don't want to see people mewing and going around just plugging up one nostril. That would be a disaster. Don't do that, children. Bad for you. So our bodies know what to do, okay? Every 30 minutes to 3 to 4 hours, your nostrils will shift from being primarily taking air in from one side to the other. And sometimes they're both open at the same time. They're constantly shifting throughout the day. Why would we evolve to do this? Well, some people believe this is the way for our bodies to help regulate our emotions, our nervous system function, our oxygen, the heat in our bodies, and more. The reason that people say this, and there's been about 24 studies to show the difference between left nostril and right nostril, is because the ancients believed that the left nostril, breathing in and out of the left nostril, was very calming for the nervous system. Okay, this is the moon side of where you are relaxing the body. Breathing out through the right is also very calming, but inhaling through the right is very activating. This is the sun side. The side that is heating the body up, that is increasing blood pressure. So you could say, cool, the ancients were interesting, but can we test this? And the answer is yes. So it turns out in the tests that have been done, all of that lines up. Your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up when you inhale through the right nostril. When you exhale and inhale through the left nostril, the opposite happens. Heart rate goes down, blood pressure goes down. Your body cools itself down. So our bodies automatically do this, but you can hack it through something called alternate nostril breathing, which has been around for thousands of years as well. A lot of people know this in yoga. It works really, really well. And the science and data is there to prove it. So at any time you're feeling stressed out, you can just hack these different nostrils, these breaths that are going in and out. And you can definitely feel the effects from it. At least I can. There are a bunch of different ways of doing this. I don't know if we want to get into it. on this podcast. I'm happy to show you one, but you know, otherwise people can look them up online or whatever.
Sure. I think one thing, because just because we're wary of the time, I think something that might kind of bring this together, it's a question about the words that you mentioned, sun and moon. Do you mean that my question is basically if that is a metaphoric way of understanding it, or if there really is this kind of literal link between the mystical world and breathing? Because this is something that we had a little bit of an issue with when we spoke to Dr. Joe Dispenza.
Mm-hmm. You know, you can believe whatever thoughts you want to believe about this. I'm going to stick with what we know and what can be measured. So I mentioned that the ancients believed that the left nostril was the more feminine side. I don't know if you can say that nowadays, but that's what they believed. And I am just a filter for the ancient knowledge here. And the right nostril was considered the masculine side, right? Cooling and heat. There was one study done looking at the different rhythms and cycles of our natural nostril breathing in the cycles of the moon. And that one study, which doesn't prove too much, showed that they are linked to the moon, to the lunar cycle of the nostrils that happen to be open and which side happened to be closed. So again, it was just one study. It doesn't prove too much, but it's interesting to think about. And again, you can look at the ancient knowledge, and they practiced these things for thousands and thousands of years. So they might be on to something. But nowadays, we live in this wonderful world where you can go out and measure things. And a lot of people have wearables where they can measure this stuff for themselves and see what works for them.
So as well as generalized health, something you talk about in the book is the impact that it can have, that different breathing can have on your sports performance. And it's something that was a bit taboo, and certain people did, but it was shunned off as not effective. But I think you said that new evidence has come to light. So could you tell us about what changing your breathing can do for sport, underbreathing can do for sport, et cetera, and how you can change your sports performance?
I think the new evidence that's come to light right now is that tens of thousands of athletes are really focusing on their breathing and seeing huge gains in performance. There are entire systems, academies right now set up to train professional soccer players, to train players in the NBA. I've spoken with a lot of these people who do this professionally, and they have said this has made such an incredible difference. And they're also a little bitter because they said, why are we just learning this now? Some of these guys are at the end of their careers, and mm-hmm. learning how to really focus on their breath is allowing them to stay in the game literally much longer than they would be able to do otherwise. So I think that, you know, sort of what I said at the beginning of the podcast is these things are so simple. It's hard to monetize breathing, even though people are really trying to do it. So some of them are successful right now. But they're so simple that people think they're not going to work until they actually do them, until they look at the data, and until they start seeing results. And this is something that is just absolutely exploding in professional sports and for amateurs, is to focus on the breath. And it's exploding because it works so well.
Mm. Am I right in saying that the issue when you're running out of it's a colloquial phrase, running out of breath, which I think is actually incorrect, because am I correct in saying that you're never actually running out of oxygen? What you're doing is you begin to not be able to tolerate the amounts of carbon dioxide that are building up. So is the performance about learning to be able to tolerate more carbon dioxide?
It is for a lot of athletes. Yeah, you're entirely right. When people feel that breathlessness, it rarely, if ever, has anything to do with oxygen, unless you're at altitude, then everything's, you know, changes. But if you're around sea level, it has to do with CO2 levels building up. So right now, if you were to exhale and hold your breath, after several seconds, you're going to feel this need to breathe, right? This nagging need to breathe that is not dictated by oxygen levels. It's dictated by rising levels of carbon dioxide. So the more CO2 you can tolerate, that you become comfortable with, for athletic performance, the better. And the reason is that CO2 helps to open up those blood vessels. Just as we had talked about before, the reason why people who suffer from anxiety and panic, they're overbreathing all the time. Having more CO2 in your body or healthy levels allow those blood vessels to stay open, allows for easier delivery of oxygen. And only in the presence of CO2 can oxygen exchange to all those hungry cells which need that oxygen. This gets into pretty complicated biochemistry, but that's how it works. So if you're overbreathing, and so many people are doing this, you go out and watch people jogging and they're just thinking they're doing themselves favors, but they're actually denying themselves an efficient way of uploading oxygen that way. So look at a professional, at a real butt-kicking marathon runner like Kipchoge, right? Look at how he's breathing as he finishes a marathon in 2 hours. He's breathing in and out through his nose. His shoulders are down, calm, relaxed, slow breaths as he's running, you know, at 13 miles per hour for 2 hours. So he's only able to compete at that level by focusing on his breath, and he is a master at it.
Yeah, I mean, we recently had Eliud Kipchoge on our podcast, and he's just
amazing.
Yeah, it went really well. And he's just such an amazing, humble guy. But just to touch on what you said about breathing slowly, I understand what you mean, but this is something which people online find often conflicting advice, right? They might see something of Wim Hof where that specific Tamo breathing technique is recommending fast breathing for a certain amount of short time. But then at the same time, you know, anxiety, breathing quickly and overbreathing with anxiety, that's a negative thing. So they're two very different things in different contexts. But how do you kind of parse them out? And for a listener who's maybe not that interested or not that knowledgeable in the specific scientific details, what's kind of the main message to keep it simple?
Yeah, isn't it confusing? So it was extremely confusing to me. As I was researching this, I was like, what the hell is going on? So this overbreathing Wim Hof method works really well for anxiety and depression, but this underbreathing works really well for anxiety. So what's happening? So these are two different sides of the same coin. What Wim Hof method and these vigorous pranayamas or kundalini practices are doing is they are purposely stressing you out, okay? They're taking a very controlled amount of time and teaching you how to max out your nervous system. This is called hormesis. This is beneficial stress. And by doing that, they're getting out all of that tension in this very small contained space so that when you leave this practice, you are calm. Right? All of that tension is gone and you are relaxed and you can go on with your day. Some people who prefer these slower breathing methods say, we can still get you to that same state, but it can take a bit longer because you are controlling, you are trying not to blow out, right? You are trying not to have those points in which your nervous system is maxing out. Two different philosophies, but they're going to the same destination. Personally, in the modern world, especially for younger people who are so stressed out, who have so much anxiety, who need to see very quick results, otherwise they just shift gears and start to do something else, I think these vigorous breathing techniques are more effective. For older people who have more patience, who don't want to feel stressed out at any time at all, I think the slower ones can be more beneficial. But it depends on your personality, who you are, and what works best for you, which is why no one can offer a blanket prescription that's going to fit for everybody. You have to explore these things yourself and see what works.
I guess the generalized advice would be breathe slowly, unless you're choosing not to breathe slowly and you're doing Tummo or something like that, and in which case you can make it an intensive exercise, right?
Beautiful summary there. So unconsciously, we're training ourselves to build a habit in which we're breathing in and out of our noses. We're breathing deep. If you place your hand on your belly, you breathe in, you should feel a slight expansion there. Okay. Most people, especially men, when they breathe in, they suck their stomachs in. This is a disaster for your health, right? Because men can be extremely vain. They don't want to show their stomachs off. They want rock hard abs all the time. So, you know, rock hard abs, great, great. They look great. But is that how you want to be breathing all the time? I don't think so. So having these proper biomechanics as an unconscious thing, breathing slow and steady rhythmically through your nose unconsciously, and then consciously turning on that breath, seeing what you can do with that breath, to having short periods of time throughout the day in which you are purposely stressing yourself out can make you much more relaxed for the rest of the day. And I think that there's a lot of benefits to it. And that's what the ice bath does, by the way. Ice bathing is not relaxing. It stresses you out. That's why it's so impactful. For a very short amount of time, you are putting your body through an incredible amount of stress and you are resetting it so it can work properly throughout the rest of the day.
Yeah, I guess it is really similar principles. You're kind of taking something to the extreme, so then you kind of reset your baseline. And one of the ways that you describe yourself doing that as well is with carbon dioxide therapy. So you describe, again, choking is, if I'm not mistaken, choking is actually not about lack of oxygen. Again, it's about a buildup of carbon dioxide, which makes you think that you're lacking oxygen. And so one of the things you do is get yourself stuffed with carbon dioxide to build up that tolerance. How effective is that for sport to bring it back?
So if we're using the term choking only in regards to people who are at a critical stage of suffering, an asthma or panic attack. So what they do is they are overbreathing so much, then something stresses them out again, and they start overbreathing more, and this slowly crests up until they reach a crisis point where they feel they can't breathe, right? And that's where they really freak out. Some people say that this is the body's response to having such low CO2 that it is trying to force them to hold their breath, to open up those blood vessels, to deliver more oxygen to all of these areas that are deficient. So that's what, when you were referring to choking, this is this crisis point for asthma or panic attacks. So what carbon dioxide therapy does, especially for populations that are habitually overbreathing and have chronically low CO2, which all of these populations I just mentioned do have, there have been studies showing that, is some people believe that this is a way of resetting the brain, specifically these chemoreceptors and their connection to the brain, resetting them so they can have these normal levels of CO2 in their bodies and be comfortable with it so that they would normally be breathing rhythmically and slowly. I know a lot of biochemistry here, it's complicated, but that's the general premise. And the CO2 therapy was used so successfully for so many decades. And then it completely disappeared. And now we know why it disappeared. This has been well studied. It's because it was stamped out by anesthesiologists who felt it was too much competition with what they were doing. And that's not a hypothesis. That's a fact. But it's starting to come back. The CO2 therapy is really starting to come back. And it works incredibly well for all those reasons I mentioned. Mm.
Obviously, you have to have access to specific facilities, the ability to have pressurized air with the right amount of carbon dioxide. For somebody who doesn't have that, is there a way you can just by breath holding, maybe just increasing your carbon dioxide naturally?
Yeah, don't go get a CO2 tank, kids. Don't get your soda stream and try to hack into that. Not good. So if you see what's happened with carbon dioxide therapy, all it's doing is making a very easy hack to what breath holding is naturally doing. So breath holding is naturally allowing you to tolerate more carbon dioxide. And the more carbon dioxide you tolerate, the calmer your body gets, the slower you will be breathing. So breath holding has been an essential part of all ancient Chinese breathing practices, Qigong. Almost every single one of those techniques includes breath holding, pranayama, means the cessation of breathing. That's what pranayama means, the control of breath. So there's breath holding throughout pranayama, kundalini, and more. So the safest and best way of building up that carbon dioxide threshold and getting all the benefits of what would be carbon dioxide therapy is to learn how to hold your breath. Wim Hof method has you hold your breath 3-4 minutes at a time. So to pranayama, so to qigong. So you can pick whatever method you want. The key is to consciously learn how to hold your breath longer, and that correlates directly with less anxiety and less asthma as well.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to know that it's not, so for example, the importance of breathing through the nose, it's not something solely related to humans. So animals breathe through their noses as well. I was wondering in that regard, if you could expand on the evolutionary advantages this might suggest about nasal versus mouth breathing in humans.
Yeah, it's so ridiculous that we have to relearn how to breathe, right? And that's what all of my friends were criticizing me about. They're like, oh, wait, we have to relearn how to breathe now. We have to relearn how to eat now. We have to relearn how to exercise. We have to relearn how to sleep. The answer is, yeah, we do. And if you are ever doubting this, look to the animal world, especially wild animals, and look at how they're breathing. Look at how they're breathing during their sleep, into their bellies, very slow, very rhythmically, always in and out of the nose. Look at how they're breathing even when they're chasing another animal down. Look at a cheetah running at 50 miles per hour. Look at how it's breathing. Look at a horse that is running at top speed, and look at how it's breathing. It's breathing in and out of its nose, very deep into the stomach. So this is exactly how we're designed to breathe. And healthy infants know this. If you look at a healthy infant and look at it breathing in and out through the nose, deep into the stomach opens up and contracts with every single breath. We lose this when we are forced to sit in chairs for 8 to 10 hours a day, when we lose our posture, when we're forced to sit in front of screens. So school is when we formalize school. All the stuff that I went through is when we lose this ability to breathe properly at the age of around 5 to 6. And you can trace this. So relearning it's not that hard, but it does take time, just like any other habit. It can take a few months. But learning this proper posture and learning this proper breathing is, I believe, absolutely as essential to health as what you're eating, how much you're sleeping, and how much you're exercising.
Well, great. Thank you so much, James. Do you have any concluding thoughts for our audience, perhaps?
I guess that the big thing is that breathing doesn't have to be complicated. We've overcomplicated our food and nutrition. We've overcomplicated exercise. We're starting to overcomplicate sleep. But the simplest things in breathing are the most effective. And don't let any breathwork people tell you otherwise. Learning how to breathe deep and slowly through your nose can really transform your health. And the science has proved it. And you can try it yourself for free and see how it works for you.
Hey guys, hope you enjoyed that episode with James Nestor. If you'd like to check out another episode, you can click right here to watch our interview with Wim Hof, the Iceman, something we touched on a little bit in this episode too. Don't forget to like and subscribe and comment your thoughts below.